And this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of books on the First Amendment, American Legal History, and Constitutional Philosophy, and scholarly articles on a variety of related topics. He is currently a visiting Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Howard Schwaber.
Oh, nice to be here.
And you're obviously a long way away from Florida, but this is the electronic age, and I'm sure you're in touch with what's happening there. Of course, it does seem that money has overwhelmed the race in terms of Mitt Romney's deep pockets and his ability to buy media in the various media markets in Florida. And it does seem, though, that Newt Gingrich is also, in terms of the politics of resentment, I think the person he most resents in the world is Mitt Romney. So whether it's personal or political, it looks like he's going to soldier on.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. It's not really so clear that money bought this election, although that's a convenient narrative. But we have actually some early exit poll results. And one of the interesting things is that, at least according to what people tell the pollsters, ads did not move people in a positive way. Some voters were turned off by the ads, and voters who felt that way particularly turned against Romney because the ads were viewed as unfair or too negative. But it was actually the debates that did the most, apparently, to sway voters toward Romney. It's also the case that in Florida there was only a very small number of voters who decided late. There were a lot of early and absentee ballots that were already locked in before the debates even happened, and the vast majority of voters say they made up their minds fairly early on. But of the voters who decided late, it was the debates rather than the ads that turned it. But the crucial thing is to realize we're only up to about 5% of the delegates needed for the nomination. This is a very, very long way to go, and Gingrich has made every indication that he intends to stay in it until the end.
Well, apparently the absentee ballots, 600,000 of which have been cast, I think about half of that number before the Gingrich victory in South Carolina, most of them are likely to go for Romney. And it would seem, though, from the latest indications from Gingrich on the stump, is that he's getting more and more incendiary. I mean, he's a man on fire.
Well, that's one way to put it. His statements are becoming more and more like the slightly out of control Newt that we know and love from the past. I think he hurt himself quite badly by proposing a 51st state consisting of a colony on the moon in his second term. And some of his attacks on Romney are becoming over the top, let's put it that way. But there are states coming up in which he will be quite strong. There's particularly just today, or I guess today my time, today or yesterday, depending which part of the world we're in, a new poll just came out that shows both Gingrich and Santorum very, very strong in Ohio and Missouri. Those are two big states with very strong evangelical populations. Those are both places where Romney could have a real challenge on his hands. So this is very far from over, and there are a lot of states coming up where Gingrich or Santorum could do very well. And if one of those two were to drop out, such that the evangelical and really hardcore conservative voters would coalesce around just one candidate, Romney could have a very serious fight in his hands. This thing is by no means locked up after today.
Well, had it not been for the divisions on the religious right and amongst the evangelicals and conservative Republicans who control the party, or at least dominate the party, it would have been all over. I mean, had they united around a candidate like a Huckabee, for example, I don't think that Romney would even be where he is today. He's been lucky in that regard. But coming up next week is Nevada, and then you've got Maine and Michigan. I think in both Nevada and Michigan, I don't think Gingrich is even going to try, because there's so many Mormons in Nevada. And Romney, of course, his father was the governor of Michigan. So Super Tuesday seems to be the best bet, right, coming up for Gingrich.
It is, but we're entering a doldrums period. For the next several weeks, there just isn't very much going on. I think you're exactly right about Nevada and Michigan. One state to watch is Missouri on February 7th, which is, it's a non-binding primary. It's sometimes called a beauty contest. But polling data, as I said, suggests that Gingrich and Santorum are both very strong there. Arizona is also probably worth watching on February 28th. But then you're right, it's March 6th, Super Tuesday, where the real action occurs. And those states include Georgia, which is Gingrich's home state, Massachusetts, which we presume Romney will take in a walk. Ohio, where Gingrich is very strong. And the kicker is Virginia. And the reason that I say that is Gingrich could be expected to do quite well in Virginia, but he's not on the ballot. His campaign did not succeed in getting him qualified in time. So we're going to get a kind of a false result from Virginia that could skew the race. But it will be important to recognize that that is a false result.
Well, apparently, Howard Schwaber, a lot of the voters down in Florida in exit polling identified themselves as Tea Party voters. So the blowout that everybody's expecting may not happen.
Well, there's a very strong Tea Party movement in Florida, but there are a couple of things going on here. Turnout is always important. Early voting is important. And Romney not only had complete domination of the airwaves in terms of ads, but on the ground, complete domination of the ground game, that is, the organization in place just in terms of people to go door-to-door, to make phone calls, to have local offices, was vastly superior to anything Gingrich could throw together. I do have some early unofficial results that suggest Romney's ahead by about 14 points. If that holds up, that's certainly a serious and decisive victory. But again, this is only the 5% mark. If the Gingrich has already given a couple of speeches in which he's basically said that his strategy is to come to the convention in a situation where there's a large block or even a majority of delegates who are opposed to Romney, and then try and get all of those anti-Romney delegates to gather around his banner. That's a strategy that can actually work. It has some difficulties, and particularly in terms of picking up Ron Paul supporters. Ron Paul is likely to do well in the caucus states that are coming up, such as Nevada and Colorado, maybe even Minnesota. So there are some definite, you know, fractures within even what we might think of as a putative anti-Romney coalition. But in principle, at least, Gingrich is unlikely to have any reason to drop out and will try and take this thing all the way to the convention. And the Florida results won't do anything to slow that down.
Again, I'm speaking with Howard Schwaber, who's a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. So this has got to be causing heartburn amongst the Republican power brokers. And, you know, I don't know about how much smoke is in their smoke-filled room. They're probably all non-smokers, but
the ones from tobacco states.
Exactly. And maybe their power is being exaggerated, but they have to be literally terrified that this is going to be another 1964 where the Goldwater insurgency, a Tea Party-like conservative movement swept him and swept aside the establishment candidate, another billionaire or a multimillionaire Rockefeller. And they don't want all of this fratricide going on all the way till August in Tampa, surely.
Oh, I have never seen an election in which the party leadership of either party was so unified in its detestation of a candidate who's posing a serious challenge. Maybe you have to go back to 64 to see it. The parallels are actually not bad. Not only is Romney a very wealthy man, as Rockefeller one was, they're both Northeast old-school Republicans, sort of pre-Tea Party, even pre-1980s moral majority-style Republican candidates. Who are loathed by the evangelical voters and the Tea Party voters and what we might call the new right that emerged during the Reagan era, but are very, very well entrenched with the leadership. The Republican Party leadership hates Gingrich, first of all, for lots of reasons, some of them personal, some of them valid, and some of them petty. But most of all, they are, as you say, terrified of him, of the havoc he can wreak in the party. And they think he's genuinely unstable. I mean, not only a beatable candidate, but a candidate who could damage the Republican brand for years to come. He does have a tendency to make wild statements. Somebody once said about him, Newt has 10 ideas a day, 2 of them are good, 6 of them are weird, and 2 of them are really very weird. And on a national stage, that not only doesn't play well, it looks crazy. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think the party leadership is terrified of Gingrich. And if we come to the convention in a situation in which Romney is weak enough that he looks defeatable, and Gingrich looks like he could put together a coalition of delegates, let's say on the second ballot perhaps, to pose a challenge, it's not impossible we'll see a genuine brokered convention. It's hard to do these days because delegates aren't bound the way they were 30 years ago. But in principle, it is still possible to have the various factions sit down and try and negotiate something. And this could become quite a wild ride indeed.
In your Huffington Post article, Howard Schwaber, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment, you say that Gingrich has become the perfect expression of what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style of American politics, in as much as he's preying on resentment and he's mythologized this elite. He said in some of his campaign speeches, he talks about how, for example, in his win down in South Carolina, he said, "I didn't win because I'm the superior debater, as the mainstream media say. I win because I know how to connect with the real American people." And he keeps talking about how somehow the American establishment is unpatriotic, and for 30 years they've taken America on the wrong path. And he is galvanizing those people out there, that silent majority who recognize the decline and fall of American values. I'm paraphrasing clearly, but at times it's all in code, and it's all rather bizarre for somebody. For example, I come from where you are now, and I see this country as being incredibly patriotic and by and large very right wing. So I don't know what he's talking about.
It isn't always all that coded, particularly when he starts talking about judges, for example. The Ninth Circuit and a particular federal judge in San Antonio, Texas, of whom he is not fond, he accuses them, and he accuses the Obama administration, of deliberately trying to, in his sense, destroy America. He isn't talking about people being misguided or wrong-headed or making mistakes. He talks a language in which there is a group of elites who are deliberately conspiring to destroy American culture and replace it with something alien. And it is bizarre. This is the reason why, there's good reason to think that Gingrich as a national candidate would be a flop, because most people look at claims like that and they sound, frankly, paranoid. It resonates very well with a very angry and very resentful base in the Tea Party movement and among some evangelical voters. It resonates well. For example, there was a letter read to Catholic churches in Florida, apparently, just yesterday, accusing the Obama administration of destroying religious freedom because the Department of Health and Human Services has ruled that Catholic medical institutions have to provide coverage for contraception. So he's drawing on some of that religious resentment and a feeling that secular elites are trying to destroy a religious way of life. He draws on a kind of nationalist resentment, which he accuses the elites of bringing in foreign or European or non-American or alien, these are all words that he uses, cultures and ways of being and trying to impose it on Americans. But the real striking thing about his rhetoric is the extent to which it's all a deliberate conspiracy by evil actors as opposed to merely misguided politics. And so he is rallying the troops to come to the barricades to fight against these evildoers. It's remarkable that there are as many voters as there are in what is a generally central right country who are persuaded by that narrative. And what's even more remarkable is how many of these same voters are buying into this narrative when 10 years ago or 20 years ago, certainly what they would have been looking for, those same groups of voters, would be something much more positive, much more a matter of looking for someone who expresses their values, shares their norms, and is a good person, whereas now they seem eager to line up behind a man who is selling himself as basically a bomb thrower.
But Howard Schwaber, do you really think that Gingrich believes what he's saying? I mean, do you think he really believes that President Obama is a Saul Alinsky radical? And that there again, that's all code, foreign, Jewish, weird, radical, subversive, and that he's the food stamp president. And, this is the guy that sat down with Nancy Pelosi and made a pitch for something to be done about global warming. When he took money from various lobbying groups, he was faithful to whatever their needs were. So he seems to be somebody that can sort of turn on an ideological dime, yet all the stuff that you're saying, all of which is true, and it is not in any way mediated, it's quite poisonous. But does he believe it?
We're getting into the realm of psychological speculation here, obviously. But consider his most recent claim about Romney, in which he says that Romney denied kosher food to Holocaust survivors in a Jewish hospital in Massachusetts, thus proving that he is, I'm not really sure, anti-Semitic? Heartless, at least. Could he possibly believe these things when he says them? The thing that strikes me about Newt Gingrich, and I'm not the first one to say that, is that he will say mutually contradictory things on two consecutive days, and in each instance give every indication of believing them absolutely. My best read on the guy is that at the moment he's speaking, he absolutely believes whatever it is that he's saying, and then he has essentially no memory of having said it.
And
I'm not sure what the psychological term is for that. There's an element of narcissism involved, I think. He creates reality inside of his own head and expresses it, and if what's inside his head changes, then the reality has changed, and that's all there is to it.
Well,
at the moment, he's doing very, very well at channeling a particular message that a particular category of voters wants to hear, and he's certainly presenting it with the utmost sincerity.
Well, when you say, Howard Schwaber, that you know you would have thought that the American electorate would be more centrist, it is a center-right country, and that it wouldn't find this kind of incendiary rhetoric appealing, there is another, I think, possibility out here. There does seem to be a lot of anger, a lot of disquiet. When you consider that the Tea Party were the ones that captured the anger about what happened on Wall Street instead of the political left that should have owned that issue, and they ran with it, and now they've elected a bunch of people, all of whom are working assiduously for Wall Street, that Wall Street has completely come back. The very people who took the global economy to the brink of extinction now seem to have as much influence, of, if not more influence, over our politics than ever. They've been able to keep the Bush tax cuts in spite of lots of efforts to overturn them. So this is a peculiar time in America where the oligarchs, if you will, are discredited, yet they are flexing their muscles in an unprecedented way.
Well, I think that's exactly right, but I think that the point is not to see this in terms of left and right. There is lots of very good reason to be angry, and you've just named a few of them. And people on the left, as well as on the right, are very disappointed in the extent to which the Obama administration is still very closely tied to Wall Street. And fairly or unfairly, you know, the presence of Tim Geithner is sort of the personalization of that relationship. But it's not really about left and right, it's about populism. The Tea Party is a right-wing populist movement, and there's a long history of right-wing populism in the United States. You know, you mentioned Goldwater. You can also think of someone like William Jennings Bryan. Gingrich is drawing on a very deep strain of American political culture. It goes all the way back to the Jacksonian period in some form or another. That is suspicious of elites in the big cities who are running things, who are the tools of the banks. You put all that together, and that's a very potent left or right-wing populist message. And that's exactly what Gingrich is doing. What's striking on the other side, on the Democratic Party side of things, is how ineffective Obama has been throughout his term at drawing on left-wing populism. All of the populists, you see it, left-wing populism in the Occupy movements, but you really don't see it very much at work in the Democratic Party. So all of the populist rage and energy that's being effectively channeled to politics right now is coming from the right. But the phenomenon cuts across those ideological lines.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Howard Schwaber. It's an odd conversation that we're having on the night of the Romney victory in Florida. Here we are talking about Gingrich, but he is clearly more interesting than Romney.
Well, he has this ability to suck all the air out of the room, even when he's losing. You can't look away, whether you're loving the show or staring in horrified fascination. It's an amazing spectacle.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of books on the First Amendment, American Legal History and Constitutional Philosophy, and scholarly articles on a variety of related topics. He's currently a visiting professor. He's actually a Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. And, of course, I spoke with Howard just shortly before we went on the air, and we were guessing the results, which have tracked pretty consistently with 50% of the vote in. Romney is at 47%, Gingrich at 32%, Santorum at 13%, and Ron Paul at 3%. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began the program just as the polls closed in Florida and were able to give an update throughout the first part of the program. Clearly, it was a pretty much a blowout for Romney, 48-37. About half the votes were counted. We know how they count votes in Florida, right? I had Michael Tomasky on as a special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and we were talking about this particularly venomous race and how apparently Gingrich, is in spite of the whipping he's getting, it doesn't look like he's going to restrain himself from continuing. Michael Tomasky seemed to think he has it. If he pulls off another win, an upset win somewhere else, he can stay in the race. The most likely one would be in Maine, given that the next one is Nevada and Michigan, both of which Romney's got an advantage in Nevada because of the Mormons and an advantage in Michigan because his father was governor. So it's not likely that Gingrich will make a dent there, but he may make some kind of a dent in Maine. But if he can pull off something like Georgia on Super Tuesday, then he can stay in there and be this bomb thrower all the way to August, which of course is music to Obama's ears. And again, you keep reminding yourself that, boy, is Obama lucky, because there's no question that by the time they get to the convention in August in Tampa, the Republicans are going to be pretty beaten up. It seems like every day that passes, it's an indication that nobody's particularly thrilled with the candidacy of Romney. But the Republicans are very hierarchical, and people have to wait their turn. Reagan had to wait his turn, and Bush Sr. had to wait his turn, and John McCain had to wait his turn. And this is the turn of Mitt the Stiff. So there we have it. Then I was joined in the studio by Matthew Kavanaugh, who's just been demonstrating in front of a hotel here in Beverly Hills, where the U.S. trade representative is meeting in secret with a bunch of titans from corporate America, particularly from Big Pharma. They're hashing out a new free trade agreement with the Pacific, which is being dubbed the NAFTA of the Pacific. And this is a deal that's leaving a lot of labor, environmental, and AIDS activists frustrated and confused. And Matthew Kavanaugh is an AIDS activist who spent a lot of time in Africa, and is pointing out how, but for the fact that the Indian Big Pharma doesn't pay the kind of royalties to American Big Pharma, they're able to provide AIDS drugs in Africa. He made the point that for Magic Johnson to stay alive, it's $13,000 a year. But the same drugs they can afford to give them away in poor African countries like Zambia. And by the way, $13,000 a year is the entire annual salary of somebody in Zambia. So he's clearly fighting the good fight, and this one's going under the radar. So it's something that we're going to have to do a lot more coverage on. And then finally, I spoke with Howard Schwaber, who's a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. And even though Newt the Nasty is losing this election, he's a hell of a lot more interesting than the guy that's winning it. And he certainly seems to be determined to tear down Romney all the way to August. And we were trying to talk about the nature of the politics of resentment, what it is that attracts the sort of Tea Party Christian conservatives to this candidate who is hardly a poster boy for family values, and what is at the heart of this nastiness. And I think to some extent we answered those questions. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.